Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast. This is the Bruegel podcast live. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm very pleased and honored to host today Roberto Cingolani. He's the minister for the ecological transition of Italy. And Italy, of course, this year plays a major role in the climate negotiations because it is a co-host of the COP26. And it is the G20 presidency. And so in both functions, there are important climate goals that need to be achieved. I'm particularly honored and pleased to host you, Minister Cingolani, because not only are you a minister, but you are also a prolific scientist. I read with very big impression that you published more than 1,000 articles in scientific journals. And so really, I think it's a rare quality that we see someone working in politics, but really also understanding the science of it. And I think this will be an additional big asset in the negotiations that are now upcoming. Minister, thank you so much for joining. We want to make this an interactive podcast that is also live streamed. So let me start by asking you, what is it that you expect from the COP26 and from your G20 presidency in the climate field? What is it that you hope for?
Yeah, so thank you for the invitation and for reminding about my background. You know, I spent fantastic years in Max Planck in Stuttgart, so I've been living in Germany for a long time also. And I will go back to my job when I will finish this experience. So just a short snap, short slot in my life. The COP26, as you know, started, the agenda of the COP26, of course, started before I joined this ministerial experience 7 months ago. So somehow I got to adapt myself to the course of the activity. I think right now something new came between the G20 ministerial meeting in Naples in July and today. We've had this important report by the IPCC institution that gave us clearly a quantitative information about the fact that we are late on the accomplishment of the Paris Agreement. So the forecast is not good. We're going to be 2.7 degrees higher than expected, and this is absolutely not good. So there is a need of more ambition. There is a need of more acceleration. And in some sense, this has revolutionized the COP26 agenda, because when the agenda was made, we had a roadmap. Now, clearly, we have to accelerate compared to that roadmap. So having said this, I would say there are two levels. The basic level is that, according to the original agenda, we should work on adaptation and mitigation, managing losses and damage. We should work on finance, so gathering more fundings for vulnerable countries. We should work on metrics, how we measure the progress and the control of the environmental parameters. And that was originally the agenda. But now with this need of acceleration, I think we have to do more. So I would say most important, all countries, including those having a strongly coal-based economy, should agree that we need to keep the challenge of the 1.5 degrees alive. So 2 degrees global warming is not too much. We should target directly to 1.5. I mean, for those who are not really in the field, that half a degree improvement makes a big difference. It means that at the poles, we might have 3 degrees less. So it's a serious change, and it's a huge effort. The second thing is that the acceleration is needed on finance. So I think that if we manage to gather the $100 billion that were promised in 2015 and never achieved, that is really mandatory. We should make it this year. And those $100 billion should leverage a lot of fundraising from private institutions. And it's well known now by the community that the $1 trillion range is what we need for a serious improvement of the situation in the vulnerable countries. I mean, in the end of the day, in the last few months, and that was something I was working hard as a president of G20 Environment and Energy, the new concept that has been acknowledged by everybody is that climate crisis, climate change on one hand, and global inequalities on the other hand, cannot be treated on a separate footing. They have to be treated together, strictly interconnected. This makes the challenge even more difficult. And in real numbers, we have 4.8 billion people in the planet, more or less, this is the G20 population, producing 80% of the greenhouse gas. were struggling with the Paris Agreement to do something good for the future, but there is also 3 billion people left behind, having no access to electricity, a part of those, having no access to clean fuel for cooking, having hard access to clean water. So even the definition of ecological transition is different in these two worlds. So when you talk in the G20, you do something. When you talk in the COP26, which is representing everybody, you know, the challenge is even more difficult. That's why I think a good target would be convincing everybody to keep the 1.5 alive and gathering the money that is needed to start a serious financial aid program for the vulnerable countries.
Thank you. So now you talked quite a bit about what we would like to see. And I think all the goals that you mentioned sound very reasonable, given where we are. And I think also, as you point out, the challenge is enormous to really get the 1.5 degrees Celsius. I mean, this is now the COP26 meeting, meaning there have been 25 meetings before. The topic is not new. We basically know the science for a very long time, the science of climate change, but we haven't really managed to convincingly address the emission problem. And in fact, I look at the issue from an economist's point of view. I see that emissions continue to grow. They haven't fallen. I mean, they have fallen a little bit last year because of the COVID recession, but the trend is clearly still an upward trend. And the decoupling speed between economic growth and emission growth is just too slow. So let me throw that question at you as a skeptic of, you know, how much we will achieve. What will we achieve at this COP? Yes, we have to be ambitious, but what can we realistically achieve given the track record?
So first of all, I think the problem is originated by a sort of a vertical description, vertical understanding of the development model. We've been based on all our forecast and all our actions in the past on the GDP growth, assuming 2% growth here and there. And this is, I mean, I'm a physicist and I can simply translate in energy is conserved. You cannot think to grow unlimited, neglecting that there is a thermodynamical impact of that growth. So I think we should have possibly developed a wider growth model, taking into account that actions have consequences always. And this is true particularly when you burn thousands of terawatts hour every year in the advanced manufacturing countries. Now I think the awareness is much better. So we know that we have to swap from a growth model that is at the expenses of the planet into a growth model that is in favor of the planet. This will guarantee growth anyway, but of course we have to change our mobility, we have to change our primary energy production, we have to change our manufacturing systems, and this takes years. It might be a little bit late, maybe, of course, but because science told this a long time ago. But of course, you know, science, politics, economy, they don't talk directly. Now, maybe this is a good opportunity to start talking more in some sense. So for the COP, what could be realistic? Well, that's a good point. I think that a problem, of course, comes from some big countries having a large population, large manufacturing systems, but also an economy based on coal. Now, convincing those economies and those countries to change very rapidly might have a huge social impact. We have to understand this, okay? At the G20 in Naples, I spoke to our Indian colleagues and to our Chinese colleagues, and they were, of course, aware of the need of the change. But in the meantime, they told in the carbon space, as advanced countries, we have occupied all the space. I know it sounds too easy to say, okay, there is no longer space, reduce your growth. And they can say our per capita production is by far higher than their production, even though the integral in their case is higher because they are 1 billion, maybe, or 1 billion and a half. Mm. So those are complex problems in which I don't take a political position. I just take, a thermodynamical position. We have to be fair in this respect. So a good point for the COP would be that those large countries agree that we have to go below 2 centigrades. Now, the way this can be done is, of course, complex. You can see through the increase of the gas price that moving large quantity of gas from Europe to the Eastern countries has changed substantially the market. And now the price of the gas in Europe is much higher. So you see, on one hand, this is a good news because maybe they phase out the coal faster and they replace with gas, but then it's a bad news because our energy bill increases substantially. I think this is the reason why the transition should last 10 to 15 years, even though we're in a hurry, but we know that it takes time. And we have to be very careful. Too fast would be socially unsustainable. Too slow would be environmentally unsustainable. I think the COP26 has to face those problems. We cannot expect the COP signing a joint document in which we say, yes, in 5 years, we all go to 1.5 centigrades, towards 1.5. But at least we have to acknowledge that this is the way. And the second thing, as I said, is the finance. We have to gather the money needed for reducing differences, global differences in the vulnerable countries. I think those are the two main issues. And I would be happy to see a good step in this direction.
Yes. So if I can push you a bit on the finance point, because I think, as you rightly pointed out, in a sense, the developed world has more than exhausted its carbon budget. I mean, we've all emitted lots of stuff in the past. I mean, Europe may not be now the main emitter, but we have done quite a bit. And similarly, the US is now the second biggest emitter in the world after China. But it has, of course, historically emitted much, much more than China. So now telling China not to grow, I think, is a proposition that is rejected by China. And as you know, China has just announced its own plans for becoming climate neutral. And the date is 2060. And until 2030, actually, emissions, also coal-based emissions, will grow massively. So how do we square the circle, really? I mean, there's really a fundamental problem here. On the one hand, we really need to cut emissions now. We can't do it after 2030. On the other hand, we can't tell countries not to grow. So there's perhaps two questions here. How much faith would you put in technology accelerating so quickly that decarbonization will become so cheap that it's actually the thing to do? So clean energy is the thing to do. So that's one question. And the other, the more political one, is how do we deal with the China issue in the next 10 years?
From my point of view, this is just a combination of two counteracting ideas. The first idea is that energy is conserved, and the heat we produce and the carbon dioxide we produce is a part of the energy generation program. So if we consume a lot of energy, we also produce a lot of carbon dioxide and the heat and so on and so forth. And this is thermodynamics, and there is no politics behind. So we have to find a compromise. So maybe we do a little bit less, they do a little bit less, and we find a reasonable time scale to reduce our emissions. But we know we don't have so much time. So that has to be done quickly. So the second part of the paradox is that we pretend to grow. We pretend to grow continuously, all with the same rate, accelerating the rate. And of course, where are the solutions? The solutions, of course, are in the compromise. But the compromise can be supported by circularity. I don't think advanced countries have invested enough in circularity. Circularity means recovering matter, means reusing, recycling, restoring natural environment. I mean, in the end of the day, the best carbon capture system is nature. Ocean, lands, forests. We didn't behave very well in that respect. The third thing is obviously technology. You see, today we have ideas about what could be a solution, but we didn't invest enough. I'm thinking to new ways.
In some areas we do. I mean, so we can produce electricity with zero emissions by now. I mean,
yes, but not continuous. So once again, thermodynamics is leading. It's not politics. So if you wanna compensate, if you wanna give continuity to fully renewable sources, I mean, Italy, it's maybe one of the best in class for renewable energies. But we have an intensive manufacturing system. We are one of the large economies. And we know we cannot make it with wind and sun, even though we are the Texas of the sun, because our country is in the middle of the Mediterranean. We have a large irradiation. And in this respect, we have a lot of energy to convert. But this is unfortunate, discontinuous. So we have to develop accumulators. So if you want to phase out the gas for the continuity, we have to develop new technologies for carbon captures. I like very much this idea that you extract carbon dioxide and transforming in calcium carbonate, like rocks. But now it's not very efficient, but maybe in the future it will. What about nuclear? I mean, obviously the solution of the problem will be when we will have a very low impact nuclear, but of course fusion is going to be the solution, capital T, because the entire universe works with fusion. But we know that fusion is maybe long-term, 2060 or so. It depends on how much effort we will make. So the point is, we need to develop and to study, to make R&D, to boost education, We need more. We need more. At the moment, we want to combine two things that are not consistent. One is the infinite growth. The other one is the right to the growth to everybody. And the third, so three things, not two things. And the third thing is that thermodynamics leads. Mm. So if we increase the consumption of energy, this has a cost. I was watching the numbers of Germany and the numbers of Italy. I think our global energy, it should be in the range of 1,000 terawatt per hour in 1 year in Italy, and you guys, 1,600. This is a sort of equivalent. You know, you take the mega ton equivalent of petrol, you know, all the primary production. Mm. And this is supposed to grow.
Right.
So if you want to grow, either you find something that does not produce pollution, or you don't grow, or you grow and pollute.
Right.
That's all. And if somebody has the right to grow as well, we should give them the opportunity to grow. And also, we have 3 billion people below the limit, and we should let these people to reach at least a reasonable standard. And this will cost carbon dioxide again. We'll need energy. So we have to rush in finding new energy sources that are clean. There is no ideology behind.
That's right.
That's all.
So now, of course, you didn't dwell much on the more political question of China, but I let me also combine that with the question on the finance, because you mentioned finance as an important element, and I think I agree with you. I mean, clearly there is a need for finance in the poorest countries, in the rising economies also, that, you know, have still difficulties accessing capital markets. I mean, there's a need to help these countries implement clean energy solutions rather quickly. So the climate finance debate and the pledge to give 100 billion per year has been there 2015. So it's been there for quite some time.
We never made it.
So what do we do now? I mean, do we need a different way of organizing that climate finance, or should it go to something else, perhaps something directly linked to CO2 emission reductions, sort of matching grants or something of that sort? I mean, what would be a useful way of setting the system up? Because so far, the big countries don't want to give that money.
Yeah, especially after the COVID, this has become difficult. But let me tell you, I don't think there exists a unique solution, just like it does not exist in technology, combination of many solutions, including hydrogen that I forgot to mention before. In the case of finance, the situation to me is as follows. So first of all, we promised something in 2015. There is no excuse now. We have to go there. Second, this is largely insufficient. We know it because it's about 100 countries that need help, and 100 billion means 1 billion per country, and this is a few tens of dollars per person per year. Nothing. So this has to be leveraged to attract investors. But for doing that, we need possibly an economical frame. We need transparency. How do we determine the nationally determined contributions? You know, today all the metrics is done based on statement. I can tell you that I reduce my carbon dioxide by 30%, but there is no common metrics to establish whether my 30% has been calculated like yours. And then all the decision pipeline is based on data that are not sort of certified or eventually agreed as a method for the measurement. So we need transparency frame. We need the nationally determined contribution with the clear metrics. We need a sort of a table or panel control where all data can be shared. And this is fundamental to make transparent decision and to make reasonable decisions. Concerning the vulnerable countries, economics are very clear. I mean, in between 2010 and 2019, if I remember correctly, I saw the statistics of the United Nations. The extreme events connected to climate change, those clearly connected to climate change, have cost something like $1,200 billion mitigation cost and about 400,000 loss of lives. And if you see the update of the statistics up to 21, those numbers were increasing. So in some sense, we should not be worried about the money that we have to collect to help the vulnerable countries. We should be worried about the money that we have to spend to mitigate the loss and the damage. This is horrible. So you see, we spend already more than 100 billion per year. So instead of mitigating
adaptation or mitigation?
No, this is mitigation. This is the cost. This is actually the cost of the catastrophic events. So rebuilding, rebuilding and restructuring things. Now, in some sense, I think we should make a gigantic step forward. That means moving from adaptation and mitigation, that means I got the problem and I tried to fix it, into predicting, into forecasting things. So I don't want a new problem to come. That is the best way to invest. We save a lot of money.
Yes.
That means technology again. Eh? That means combining satellites data with drones, land sensors, sensor diffusions, exploiting cloud computing, running forecasting models that are seriously done. And in that way, you can really do a lot. We have now hurricanes in Sicily. There never been anything like that in the past. I think you've seen yesterday in Catania. We have a lot of damage there. And there's another one coming, which will be worse than the one of yesterday. I think it's expected by tomorrow. This is a hurricane. You know, it's just a cyclone phenomenon. I mean, we have never seen this in the Mediterranean. We are not equipped for that. So if I count how much this will cost in the next 10, 15, 20 years, I better put my money now to prevent, rather than complaining and waiting the new hurricanes came every year. So this is what we have to do.
But it seems to me, if I may push you on that point, that we need both, right? I mean, so we know that climate change is there with us. I mean, it will not get better in the next 10 years. It will get worse in the next 10 years for sure. I mean, this is already unavoidable that it will get worse in the next 10 years. Now, afterwards, we might see some improvements if everybody steps up now, but it will get worse in the next 10 to 20 years. So adaptation spending, dealing with catastrophic events will be a central part of the climate reaction in the next two decades. I'm convinced of that.
Sure. This is the present. We have to do now. But prevention is the future.
Absolutely.
So, how to say, if we are late in prevention, the next problem that will manifest themselves will be really harder than the one we have today. So it is not enough to make mitigation. That is my point. That's why the 100 billions is nothing. 100 billions possibly is a part of prevention.
So let's talk in our last few minutes about the G20 that Italy presides currently. What is your top agenda item in the G20 discussions? What is it that you want to achieve there? Is it also finance, or what are the main points you want to achieve there?
Well, after Naples, we got two unanimous conclusions, one about the environment, the other one about energy. There were 60 points in the energy, and only 2 points were upshifted to the G20 of the prime ministers. On all the others, we agreed. And about the environment, there were 25 over 25 agreed. So I think the G20 has already, how to say, performed. Now, I would expect, I would hope that in the next and last G20 meeting this year for the head of the governments, there will be a common landing point about the face off to the call, China, Russia, and the big countries, India. That was the only one we could not agree solely with the energy and environment teams, because that was too much impacting on the economy and social situations. So it was fair to give another opportunity for discussion. But I think in this respect, all the preparatory work for the COP was successful. And we've seen also the impact on the pre-COP was good. So I think let's wait for this last point about the face of the call, and of course the reduction of the incentives for coal-based actions. They're disconnected, of course. But I'm sure that in this respect, there will be a convergence. Maybe not 100%, but you know, little steps year by year are moving in the right direction. The COP26, of course, is more complicated because the differences among the G20 countries are big, but not enormous. So it's easier to find a compromise for all the countries. In the COP26, the differences are enormous, more than 190 countries, in which the differences have to be plotted on a logarithmic scale. And that means finding an agreement, a compromise there is very, very difficult. We have to be fair in this analysis.
And being a European minister, do the European countries all pull on the same string, or do we see a unified position, or do we see need for improvement in that space?
Europe is like a family. We might fight like brothers or mother and father and so on and so forth. But I mean, this month we had two ministerial meetings from Europe, the 27th. The beginning of October, we had the one on environment, and a few days ago in Luxembourg, both. It was about energy. So I had both delegations, so I attended both. And I can say, okay, there are differences, but you know, it's a family difference. When we talk about the global difference, the COP26 and so on, that is not a family. That is really a universe. It's much more complicated. Europe produces, as you know, 9% of the global emission, Italy 1% approximately. We are doing very well when we are the leading continent. Okay, it's fair that we discuss. I mean, even Italy and Germany and something they have different ideas. For instance, the global storage for gas and so on. But you know, we play home actually. I don't see the problem in Europe. We are leading the world and we're also setting up the agenda. Now, you might say, okay, why all this effort to cancel 8% of carbonization when the others are pumping carbon dioxide a lot in the atmosphere? Because we give the example, because we create the culture in the planet.
So, and we develop the technology also.
And we develop, right, of course. So, you know, we have a leading role. There must be not only the Americans, okay? In this case, it's Europe that is leading. And this is a cultural leadership. We are the old continent. And I think we should keep this always in mind. It's fair that we discuss in the family, but we all know that with respect to the world, we are the leading continent. And we really have a big duty bringing all the others along on our actions.
Roberto Cingolani, thank you so much for your intervention today. What a nice way to end this conversation by really emphasizing how much European nations work together, how much we are a family, and how we as an old continent and as a cultural continent lead the global debate on climate change. I think this is a real big asset, and I hope that we will be able to really show this leadership and achieve ambitious goals at the COP26. Thank you so much for joining, and thank you for our listeners for listening.
Vielen Dank, Herr Burger. Das ist schön. Tschüss, alle.
Dankeschön. Bye-bye.